From now through the month of June, I will be focusing on relationships. Today's sermon, what does a healthy family look like? My text is from the second chapter of the book of Kings, 1 Kings, on page 291, if you'd like to follow me along, beginning to read with verse 1. David is an old man now, and he is about to die, and so we pick up the story. When David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, saying, I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. That the Lord may establish his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you a man on the throne of Israel. And then he gives some final instructions of a practical nature to his son. And then I read at verse 7. But the Gileadite, the sons of Barzillai, let them be among those who eat at your table. For with such loyalty they met me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. And that is our text. For they took care of me when I fled from your brother, Absalom. Let us pray silently for a moment. In Christ's name. Amen. Like all of you, I prefer good news to bad news. I like joy better than sadness. I prefer health to pain. I like a smile better than a frown. Laughter better than tears. Praise better than scorn. I prefer a book with a decisive, happy ending rather than one with an inconclusive final chapter. But I have learned, irregardless of what I might like, that one has to deal with reality and with the facts. I wish it were different, but the picture of the American home before us today is not an altogether attractive picture. The home during the last 20 years in particular, and for the last 30 years in general, has continued to deteriorate. During my years of ministry here at the Peachtree Church, we have seen an escalation of the changing face of the family. We do not yet know, for example, the effect that working mothers will have on the next generation. Step families are on the increase. Single parent homes are increasing. Divorce continues to escalate. The number of people living together without benefit of marriage is on the increase. There will be an increase of male and female homosexuality as more and more people of this persuasion will be coming out of the closet. In a recent report to the President of the United States entitled The Family, Preserving America's Future, the authors of that report did an analysis of the children who entered the school systems of this nation in 1986, 3.6 million of those children. And the report is very revealing. 14% of them were children of unmarried parents. 10% of them will live in broken homes before they reach the age of 18. Between one-third and one-quarter of them are latchkey children as they enter school with no one to greet them when they come home from school at the end of the day. Other trends in that report are equally disturbing. In 1960, there were 393,000 divorces. In 1985, it had increased to 1,187,000 per year. Births out of wedlock as a percentage of all babies being born increased more than 450% during the last 30 years. When you add those grim facts to the daily realities of abortions and wife battering and child abuse, every 2 minutes in America, a child is being attacked by one or both of its parents. Incest, kidnappings, the accelerating suicide rate among the young, neglect, pornography involving children, juvenile crime, and a veritable epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases, many of them new and virulent, you realize that the report to our president on preserving the American heritage was not exaggerated in the least. The family needs help today. But let me tell you this, the family is here to stay. It was God's invention for the basic development of humankind. In spite of the pressures of incredible reality and change, the basic family is here to stay and will continue. I read recently about a little town in North Carolina. As one approaches that town, it's nestled in the mountains, you cannot miss a large sign that the citizens have erected there. It reads, quote, "We understand that a serious recession is supposed to happen this year, but we have decided not to participate in it." I like that. It's a town filled with optimists. That's my attitude today about the family. I, like you, am tired of all of the grim statistics, which leaves us with a sense of utter hopelessness. I went back and analyzed my preaching during the last 17-plus years, and I realized as I got into it that I have spent more than 25% of my time standing in this pulpit speaking about the family. I have devoted 25% of my ministry in trying to strengthen the family in this place. So today, I want us to look at what a healthy family looks like, to look at those qualities of family life that promote strength and wholesome values. Let's not be preoccupied with the rootage of all of our problems that causes the family to deteriorate. And I have selected as the background upon which to build my thoughts, the family of King David, the king of Israel. He was the greatest king that Israel ever had, but his family life was an utter shambles. And when he came to the final summons that all of us face, he called his son and successor Solomon to his bedside, and he gave him some final instructions. The Hebrew word for what he did is the word charge, from which we have drawn the concept of the last will and testament. Two things stand out in what David said to Solomon that day. He counseled his son to be faithful to God, to obey him, and that God would bless him. In a rare admission, though, David acknowledges that all had not been well in the life of his family, that his was not a healthy family. In fact, he said, "Be kind to the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite. Make them permanent guests of the king, for they took care of me when I fled from your brother Absalom." When I fled from your brother Absalom, a father fleeing from his son, a father in danger from the anger of his son. Here at the end of his life, David is acknowledging that he had family problems. Behind that deathbed statement is a sad, sad story of one man's family. It is a story of incest. David's son Amnon raped his sister Tamar, and Tamar was the much-beloved sister of Absalom. And Absalom hated his brother and resented his father, who did nothing about that incident. It is a story of murder, resentment building in the heart of Absalom, and yet his brother Amnon killed. It is a story of growing estrangement. When this happened, David got angry and sent Absalom away. If you'll read the record carefully, you will find that he went and spent some days with his grandfather. It is a story of an unfolding rebellion. Absalom, when he was finally allowed to return from exile to come home, was not received by his father. And because he was not received, his anger grew and he plotted to win the favor of his people so that he could actually, in a palace coup, overthrow his dad. It is a strange and bitter story. David missed the boy, but would not receive him at the palace. It is a story of destruction. The armies of the king put down the rebellion that Absalom led, and Absalom is killed by Joab. And one cannot read the anguish and agony that poured out of the heart of the king when he learned of the death of his son. His family life, friends, was a zoo. It began with adultery. It played itself out with incest and murder and estrangement and hatred and rebellion. And finally, the ruin of it all collapsed around David. And now, as he prepared to die, he was trying to make it right for those who had shielded him in a time of danger from his own son. Some of us here today, not to the same extent, of course, but to some degree, we know what an unhealthy family life produces in stress and in heartache. I know what it is producing in many of your lives, for you have shared it with me in confidence. We worry and wonder what can happen and what might happen to our children. Let me tell you that whatever is happening in your family between husband and wife, your children are soaking it up, good or bad, like a sponge. They know far more what is unfolding between mom and dad than you realize. The headlines scream at us daily about what is wrong. But what is right with the family? What does a healthy family look like? Depending on who you read, you can pick up dozens of insights into the picture of a healthy family. Dr. Nick Stinnett, after studying 3,000 families, found 6 main qualities that make up a healthy family. He says that strong families are committed to the family. They spend time together. They have good communication. They express appreciation for each other. They have a spiritual commitment. They're able to solve problems in crises. So drawing on all that I've read and remembering all that I have experienced in family and with many families that were both healthy and unhealthy, I offer you today Harrington's analysis of what a healthy and strong family looks like. I have 4 things to say. A healthy family, first of all, has made a commitment to spend time together. It seems so logical, so basic, so easy to say, but my, it is difficult to do, to spend time together. I have the feeling that on any given moment, half of this congregation on any given day is in midair, headed somewhere, or headed back from somewhere. With the demands of, there are families in this church that the husband leaves on late Sunday afternoon or early Monday morning and does not return until Friday, traveling all over this country and beyond during the week. There are strains upon families today to spend time together in this hurry-up, revved-up society of ours. David was unable to spend time with his family. He had wars to fight and borders to be made secure and leadership to furnish to a nation. He didn't have time to see the mounting, seething resentment that was developing in the palace. He was not there. The formative years of your children pass but once. You have one chance and one chance only to impact their lives. And you need to spend time together. You need time just to talk, to laugh, to share, to cry, to plan, to resolve conflicts, to listen, to affirm, to appreciate. It takes time to do it in a productive fashion. Woodrow Wilson, when President of the United States, said, "It's an awful thing to be the President of the United States. It means giving up nearly everything that one holds dear. The presidency becomes a barrier between a man and his wife, between a man and his children." Friends, you don't have to be President of the United States for that to happen. It's happening every day that you live and that I live. I see it daily in the life of this church. It can happen to any busy person driving for the top, reaching for their dreams. Before you know it, there's no time for anyone who needs you. It takes quality time, persistence, regular time for a family to be healthy. Everyone in the family has to be committed to giving time to one another. But this is the age of the half-read page, the quick hash and the mad dash, and the bright night with the nerves tight, the plane hop with the brief stop, the lamp tan in a short span, a big shot in a good spot, the brain strain and the heart pain, the cap nap and the spring snaps, and the day is done. The manner of life being described in those words is so familiar to most of us and so painful to many. Remember, you heard it, that the family that is healthy spends time together. And then secondly, the family that is healthy cares enough about one another to express love. There's no doubt in my mind that if David had loved Absalom, if he had spoken to Amnon and said, "You've done a terrible thing. Get things right with your brother and with your sister that you have ravished. Face up to the error of your ways." The family, if he had taken the time to be loving. This is Mother's Day, in case you missed it. Take time today to say, "I love you," to the mother of your children, and to say you love each other. Healthy families care enough about it to express it. I don't mean handshakes in the kitchen. I mean kissing and hugging and do a lot of it. We in the Harrington family do a lot of it. I'll never forget the first time our son-in-law came by the house when he and Vicki returned from their wedding trip. I love that boy. We call him Harold the Magnificent. Somebody asked me how I felt the day I handed Vicki's hand to him in marriage, and I remembered something a preacher friend told me about giving his daughter in marriage. He said, "The day I handed her hand to that boy, I felt like I was handing a Stradivarius violin to a gorilla." He's made his place. And anyhow, they come back from the wedding trip. He walks in. I kiss Vicki. I hug her neck. Intuitively, I turned and embraced him. Why? He's in the family. He's in the family. That's what families are all about. You ought to be loving one another. Affirming. And you know, many of the pictures I get of the family is that every family member has a toothpick and they're going trying to make everybody over, being critical and nagging and sharp. Let me tell you, friends, words wound. Words wound. And many a family is sunk under the sea of harsh words. Words buried into the psyche can keep you awake at night and immobilize you. Families need to be loving one another, not throwing harpoons into each other's sides. I'm amazed as I see distressed families at how unkind people can be to one another. I know people that one stroke would be like a cup of water to a man in the desert. Remember, healthy families appreciate and love one another, and they express it. Healthy families also, thirdly, confront reality. Crises, conflicts are dealt with and resolved if possible, but they are faced. That's what happened to David. He didn't face a bomb that was ticking away in the bosom of his family. Anne Murray said something that was later set to music. I cried a tear, you wiped it dry. I was confused, you cleared my mind. I sold my soul, you bought it back for me, and held me up and gave me dignity. Somehow, you needed me. You see, the problem was dealt with and resolved. And then fourthly, the healthy family, in my judgment, has a common faith. Spiritually, we cannot give our children what we do not have. You cannot teach your child the value of truth if you constantly present a picture of falsehood. When we baptize our children, we promise to teach them the doctrines of our holy religion. That's why families, husband and wife, ought to be in the same church. How can you teach them the doctrines of our holy religion if you're going off to separate churches? Find yourself a common church and get in it. The sooner the better. Religion is more caught in the family than it is taught. And it's caught substantially by example. We can talk to our children about love and compassion and concern for each other and others, but if the example they constantly see is harsh words and conflict and running roughshod over other people, then our words have no impact because of the erosion of our example. A healthy family is undergirded and sustained by a common faith. It is troubling to me that we often do everything for our children but provide them with a spiritual direction. We tell them, teach them how to walk, but never give them a clue as to where they should be walking. We are obsessed with them having a good secular education, but very blasé about giving them spiritual nurture and a good Christian education. We somehow or another expect other people to teach our children in Sunday school. If you are a mom and a dad in this church and you have preschool and elementary children, you are expected to be teaching Sunday school. Nobody's going to do it for you. We are collectively in this boat together. In early 1988, I read an article in Sports Illustrated that I've never been able to get out of my mind. It was entitled, Bred to be a Superstar. It was the story of Todd Marinovich, who at that time was the nation's most outstanding high school quarterback. He'd passed for 9,914 yards, and no less than 100 colleges were just falling over themselves to offer him a scholarship. I wish I had not read the article. It's mind-boggling. It is a story of parental fanaticism at the point of sport. He is, in a real sense, America's first test tube athlete. He has never eaten a Big Mac or had an Oreo cookie. And Bennett Brown and I are world-class former consumers of Oreo cookies. And he's missed something. He'd been on a special diet, get this boy, to enhance his physical development all his life. Experts have been engaged to address his physical development, agility, flexibility, quickness, endurance, and nutrition. Along the way, his mom and dad were divorced. He and his father live in a one-bedroom apartment. The boy sleeps in the bed. The dad sleeps on the couch. His mother lives with her parents. And his father, in the article, said, I think I'm a tyrant, but I think you have to be to succeed. And then he says, I suppose it was a little overdone. You bet. What's going to happen to that boy if he fails? Or if he injures his knee and can't play football? What does he have to rely on to sustain him through good times and bad times? It doesn't give you a clue, the article. A healthy family has a common faith. Well, I must close. I'm into the paintings of Norman Rockwell. I always have been. I'm into realism, and his paintings tell you something that is real. I was once in a room filled with originals by Picasso, and I felt my glasses needed changing. One of my most One of my favorites of Norman Rockwell is entitled Sunday Morning, and it shows you a picture. There's a messy living room that a mom and two children, they have dressed up on the way to Sunday school and church. They're moving through. They have to walk around a fella, the father, unshaven, in a bathrobe, sitting in the clutter of all of the morning paper. He's been there a while. He's going to be there longer. The picture is obvious. Sunday means something far different to him than it does to them. They're ready to go to church. He's sitting at home. They will be sitting in a pew. He'll be sitting in an easy chair. They will be reading their Bibles. He will be reading the comments and the sports page. They will be following the church bulletin as they worship. He will eventually reach for the TV guide. It's Sunday morning. And the painting tells of a family divided, not united. They are worlds apart. Let me tell you, the example of that father will make an impact, a powerful impact on those children as they grow. Thank God for a faithful mother who is doing what she can. Rockwell's painting raises a powerful question, but it gives no answer. For only you can answer it. The question is this. Is that a picture of your home? Is it a picture of your den on Sunday morning? For many of you, it is. What are you going to do about it? For God's sake and for the sake of the children He has committed to your care. We give thanks, our Father, for these moments together. On this Mother's Day, we rejoice in the love of family, and we go forth now to make our families healthy.